Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, April 24, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group telephone conference call. Today, we'll be discussing the rule of law in Venezuela. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome as our guest Ambassador Roger Noriego. Ambassador Noriego is currently founder and the managing director at Vision Americas and a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. He was U.S. Ambassador to the Organization of American States, and he's held many other government positions dealing with foreign relations and foreign policy. As always, his full bio has been made available on the Federalist Society's website and in the notice you received of today's call, so I'm brief with my introduction. He's going to begin with about 10 to 15 minutes of opening remarks on our topic, and then we'll turn to the audience for questions. So with that, Ambassador Noriega, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Great. Thank you very much for the opportunity. It's a pleasure to be with you to talk about an issue that I think the American people should be concerned about, because Venezuela has, in the last 15 years under Hugo Chavez, been converted into a narco state that is also the best friend of Iran and Hezbollah in our hemisphere. It now is a de facto regime that is even less accountable to any sort of regional pressure or attention. Chavez started out in 1998, having been elected democratically, to immediately undermine the democratic institutions in the country, concentrate all of the power in the hands of the presidency, and systematically politicize the courts, the police forces, the penal system, to where now you have a serious security crisis in the country that I think was sort of consciously engendered to undermine the ability of the private sector to operate, for opposition folks to conduct sort of normal political activity in the country, to put everyone on edge, essentially, and to put the institutions of law enforcement and the National Congress and even the electoral authorities at the disposition of the presidency. So a simple declarative statement about the rule of law in Venezuela is that there is hardly any left. And this was made even more complicated by the April 14th election in Venezuela, where Nicolas Maduro, the handpicked successor of Hugo Chavez, purportedly won an election to a six-year term. In point of fact, there's mounting evidence, some of which I have access to and which we'll be publishing very soon, that says that the advantages of the ruling party were really incredibly, outrageously unfair, and that in point of fact they had to resort to outright fraud in order to win the election for the sort of hapless Nicolas Maduro, who performed very, very poorly on the campaign trail and failed to mobilize his own base. And even the sophisticated party machinery of Chavismo was unable to deliver a victory for him. So the problem gets even worse. So let's go through some of the comments I made a little bit about the fact that Venezuela is a narco state and why that's important to us. Clearly, Venezuela being very closely located near Colombia in the transit corridor northward to the Caribbean, to the North American market for cocaine, puts it in a unique position, and it's always been in that position to have a role in narco-trafficking. Under Chavismo, under the current regime, starting in earnest around 2005, Venezuelan security officials, mostly military, but some politicians, became more and more involved in helping the Colombian guerrillas, which they've basically been partnered with for more than 20 years in certain ways, to get the cocaine to the North American market, to the United States, mostly through Central America and Venezuela. There has been what one State Department official who's responsible for narcotics control has described as an explosion of cocaine, a substantial increase in the amount of cocaine moving through Venezuela. The term narco-state is something that used to be bandied about in the 80s in sort of irresponsible ways, but in this case, you have the president of the National Assembly, a current governor of Trujillo State, the former minister of defense, the just previous army chief, and the vice minister of interior, who's responsible for drug control, who have all been implicated publicly and in certain cases directly to U.S. law enforcement through as part of investigations, implicated in cocaine smuggling. There are vast sums of money that are coursing through Venezuela's banks, through even the state-run oil company PDVSA, which really implicates some of the key institutions and most of the financial sector in money laundering that facilitates the drug trade. So that is a problem that is really metastasized. And it sows mayhem, not only in Colombia, where the guerrillas exist through this trade, but also in Central America, where Honduras and Guatemala, two small states that do not have the resources, the strong enough institutions to fend off this narco-trafficking, are really being seriously threatened by this traffic through Venezuela, up through the Central American area, through Mexico as well. So literally on our doorstep, this lawlessness, bloodthirsty drug trafficking poses a threat to U.S. Security. The second issue I'd like to discuss is their relationship with Iran. Evidence that we've collected suggests that the Iranian government has been able to launder tens of billions of dollars through the oil economy of Venezuela. So it's a third world country, but it has a first world financial system because of the petroleum economy. They've moved $1 trillion through the Venezuelan economy has moved about $1 trillion worth of oil revenue through its institutions. And so it's easy, really, quite frankly, to launder substantial transactions through the Venezuelan financial system, particularly when the state is compliant, when the state actually forces private banks to take what they know to be Iranian money in violation of international sanctions. The Iranians have also established their own banks, wholly owned by Iranian banks, for example, the Sadarat Bank, which is explicitly sanctioned by the United States and Europe and the UN. Also, they've established joint banks, Banco Internacional de Desarrollo, between Venezuela and Iran, a Venezuelan institution that is wholly owned and operated by Iranians. So that is part of the story. The other concern that we have is suspicious industrial facilities that some of which are established by companies associated with the IRGC also companies that happen to be sanctioned for their involvement in the illicit nuclear program or the ballistic missile program, having industrial footprint in the Western Hemisphere. It's also fairly clear that the Iranians have been exploring for uranium, and there's anecdotal information that they've actually mined and exported from Venezuela uranium ore. So that is clearly a matter of international concern, certainly should be to the United States. The third area is Hezbollah. Wherever Iran is, Hezbollah is usually there. For example, in the Americas, the legacy of Hezbollah is the 92 and 94 bombings in Buenos Aires that left about 150 people dead, bombing of the Israeli embassy and the Jewish community center, in which Iranian officials have been implicated, including the current Minister of Defense, Ahmad Vahidi, as well as embassy officials of the Iranian embassy who were assigned there at that time, who now, incidentally, travel to and from the region, notwithstanding the fact that there's a Interpol red notice against them in the case of Mohsen Rabbani, who travels to the region not only to Venezuela, but also at least to Brazil, and to meet with the operatives that he recruited when he was stationed in Buenos Aires in the early 1990s. There is increasing alarm, I think, on the part of some U.S. officials who are paying particularly close attention to this about what this presence, what these cells that they've been cultivating represents, what kind of threat it represents to U.S. security. For example, one of the networks operating in Venezuela is the Nasreddin network, headed by Ghazi Atif Nasreddin Abu Ali, who is, believe it or not, a Venezuelan diplomat stationed in Damascus. His brothers and father operate a radical network, training, recruiting, fundraising in Venezuela, not just with impunity, but actually the complicity of the government, and also radical anti-Semitic individuals in Venezuela have held senior posts and still hold senior posts in the Venezuelan government, from which they've used their authority to issue thousands of documents to people of Middle Eastern background who don't happen to be Venezuelan citizens, but they're able to travel on these documents. So this is a serious problem that will probably grow worse if we're not able to do something to hold this current regime more accountable. This is now a regime that has not thus far been recognized by the United States government. I think the Obama administration has done a responsible job refusing to recognize the election of Nicolas Maduro in light of the closeness of the purported results and the failure to have a full recount that satisfies half of the population or more that voted for the opposition candidate. So there's an opportunity to get some leverage on that regime, and it remains to be seen whether we'll succeed in that regard. Certainly, before we normalize relationship or recognize that regime, one would hope some of the concerns that I've just discussed about the involvement in drug trafficking and the relationship with Iran and Hezbollah would be on the table, and we would insist on significant changes in the way they do business and the nature of their relationships, and failure to cooperate, at the very least, with U.S. anti-drug activities. The regime will be under a lot of pressure internally. The economy is really melting down because of terrible policies, wrong-headed policies, mismanagement of the petroleum sector, where petroleum production is down substantially since Chavez took power. The actual production is about 2.4 million barrels a day today, down from a peak of 3.3 before Chavez took power in 1999. So they're underperforming in that area. It's just not sustainable. The infrastructure's crumbling, not only in the oil sector, but in the economy in general. There's bitter infighting within the movement of Chavismo that Maduro probably is not capable of managing on his own. And he has been depending an awful lot on Cuban handlers. And there are about 30,000 Cuban advisors, by the way, in Venezuela today in different areas of the economy. But they're taking a more and more obvious role in managing the political succession that's been going on since Chavez was diagnosed with cancer. And many people within Chavez's own movement are rejecting that Cuban interference. I think it will be very difficult for Maduro to continue to govern as more and more evidence about his corruption and fraudulent elections becomes public. They will not have probably the kind of support that they've had from China in the past. Note that before Chavez was reelected in October of last year, the Chinese had pumped about $28 billion in new money into the economy in just the 18 months before that election. That is not happening anymore because the Venezuelan oil company really doesn't have any more to sell to the Chinese, and also the Chinese are concerned about the legitimacy of the government and whether they'll ever be able to collect on any of these loans. So it is clearly going to be a very difficult period ahead in Venezuela, and because of some of the concerns that I've mentioned, it will be a challenge to U.S. security if we're not able to manage this matter in an effective way. So I'll stop there and take any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Ambassador. I'll now open the floor to questions in a moment. You're going to hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for Ambassador Noriega, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for Ambassador Noriega, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. While we wait to see if there are audience questions, let me ask you, Ambassador, you mentioned some research, your expectation that you'd be publishing it soon. I wonder if you could give us any more concrete information on when you might publish and where we could look for that publication.
Sure. Well, what we're going to be publishing really are a series of documents that we've obtained from sources within the Venezuelan ruling party, believe it or not, within Chavismo itself, that shows the very sophisticated party apparatus and get-out-the-vote mechanism that they had in place, which was, it's really the envy of any political party, except the problem is it was developed with official electoral data that was made exclusively available to the ruling party and not to the opposition. So they have a structural unfair advantage and absolute collusion between the electoral authorities and the ruling party. And on top of that, it's all managed by a Cuban team. So you have the foreign interference. And essentially what we'll sort of lay out is the unfair advantages that that the system provided to Chavismo, and we'll also mention the Cuban interference and provide evidence of that involvement in the elections, and note that they essentially stole the election because Maduro's campaign was so underwhelming it failed to mobilize the base. There was no enthusiasm, and as a result, in Chavismo's strongholds, there was an extraordinarily low level of participation. They just didn't get out the vote, and so as a final recourse, they had to actually cook the books, and they knew exactly where to cook the books because they knew through this sophisticated system where the opposition did not have poll watchers. So I think it will be another bit of evidence of the illegitimacy of the regime, and perhaps further undermine Maduro's legitimacy, certainly, and his ability to manage the problems in the country, that will lead even some within his Chavista movement to reach out to the opposition and look for some sort of peaceful resolution, some sort of political arrangement for going forward.
And that'd be a political arrangement, to be sure, rather than some kind of formal protest or something like that, I take it.
At this point, they are, you know, it's going to be difficult to sort of have a formal recount of the vote and that sort of thing.
Right.
Enrique Capriles Radonski, who's the opposition candidate, has refused to recognize the results, and they have access to tally sheets that give them fairly good assurances that he actually won by a wide margin before the electoral authorities sort of stopped the count and said that Maduro won a narrow victory of about 200,000 votes out of about 15 million cast. So, by the way, the Electoral Authority website does not have any of these results posted anymore. So, there's a presumption that there's a problem. It will be hard for Capriles to make a formal challenge because the Chavistas will not want to acknowledge that they actually lost and stole the election, and I think they'll be more inclined to have some sort of a political arrangement so the country can be governed.
Very good. We're speaking with Ambassador Noriega. We've got a couple people with questions. Let's go to our first audience member.
Yes, my name is Marianne McGrail. I'm with the D.C. Bar International Law Committee. Ambassador, I came on the call a few minutes late, so you may have covered this, but I'm wondering if you have a sense of the origins of the Hezbollah connection to the Venezuelan government.
Well, there are a couple of channels. One is Mohsen Rabbani, the name that I mentioned, who's a radical Iranian cleric who operates a network in the region that reaches can be traced back to when he was stationed in Argentina in the 1990s. That reaches into Chile, and certainly in Brazil, where his brother runs an Islamic center, but also in other countries in Central America, where these people have operated. I have personally talked with senior security officials in Peru, Chile, and Colombia, and Panama, all of whom refer to people of Iranian or Lebanese descent who are caught traveling on Venezuelan passports, and they can't even speak Spanish. And this is going back for a period of years. So that's one part of this. Then there's another very serious network, the Nasser al-Din network that I referred to, run by a guy who is actually the deputy chief of mission of Venezuela in Damascus. He became a Venezuelan citizen about a dozen years ago. He was originally born in Lebanon. And his operation in Damascus generates Venezuelan documentation, visas to travel, and therefore able to move in and out of the Western Hemisphere, or for that matter, anywhere in the world, with these phony documents. He also has arranged for the training of recruits from who've been radicalized in various countries in South America, who've traveled to Venezuela for training. In one case, at least, on Margarita Island, which is a Venezuelan Caribbean island, where they receive training and orientation, and in certain cases are sent to a center in Qom for follow-on training. Then these people return to their countries in South America as what one South American security official referred to as sleeper cells in their countries. The Nasreddin network also has been detected in carrying out certain very worrisome activities in Mexico. That hasn't been made public yet, but it is something that it has the attention of U.S. law enforcement because of the proximity to the U.S. And some of the activities they're involved in. Also, there's a very, very important aspect in terms of what Hezbollah is doing in Latin America, and this has a lot to do with Venezuelan support. They've essentially, because Chavez was running a narco state, he's able to broker relationships between Hezbollah and the narco trafficking organizations and the Colombian guerrilla group FARC, which is directly involved in the narco trafficking business. And so you've seen that the U.S. government has detected in at least one case dismantled a money laundering operation that laundered as much as $200 million a month through by to launder the money, the proceeds of sale of cocaine from Colombia up into North America, and the proceeds then being laundered through country banks in Lebanon, with the money then making its way to Europe and to other places. So Hezbollah is able to operate essentially with the support of the Venezuelan economic and political institutions and private banks and public entities, and with Iranian support. So it is an area that is fertile for more and more U.S. law enforcement attention, and I hope that they continue to put resources behind that problem.
Thank you.
Once again, if you have a question for Ambassador Noriega, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We have one more caller question at this point, and then our lines are open. So push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Good afternoon, Ambassador Noriega. My name is Farouk Samer with DLA Piper in Miami. My question basically relates to those of us who do follow Venezuela. One thing that's particularly striking is that they do have they place a lot of emphasis on legality in the sense that, or formal legality. It's a remarkable thing, but they do seem to go out of their way to at least have sort of a veneer of formal legality on sort of very often aggressively, you know, illegal acts. For example, I think just even with this election, Mr. Maduro claimed that he wanted a recount, but then deferred to the decision of the court, which I think allowed something far more limited. Could you comment on that element of this regime and whether or not post-Chavez they'll be able to sustain this?
Well, that's an excellent question, because Chavez was a brilliant guy, and he recognized from the very beginning that he had to maintain a certain formality behind his government. So you would have this patina of legitimacy. For example, they have a drug czar in Venezuela, and they've always had a drug czar in Venezuela. The concern that we've had for the last 10 years is that drug czar has been actually abetting drug trafficking instead of stopping it. They have a national assembly in Venezuela, it was elected in September 2010 in an election where the opposition actually got a substantial majority of the votes, and the Chavistas even had to concede that the opposition won, that the opposition slate won a majority of the votes. But they then the ruling party had already engineered, gerrymandered the seats and weighted the vote to ensure that they have a distinct, that the Chavistas have a distinct majority in the actual number of seats. And, you know, so they have this, you know, they have courts, but, you know, the head of the criminal courts of Venezuela actually defected about a year ago to the United States, Eladio Aponte Ponte, who explains how he used his position as a jurist to actually fix drug cases and other political cases and to harass opposition folks using the courts. So will they be able to hold this together? You know, they have an electoral authority that's supposedly independent, but they're all but one of the five members is a Chavista. And I'm not talking about just sort of people who have an R or a D behind their name on their voter registration, but I'm talking about fierce activists of the regime who ran that election. And the information that we're going to be publishing soon will show an absolute collusion between the electoral authorities and the ruling party, the Socialist Party, not only at the highest levels, but even in tactical decisions by whom they appointed to run the actual balloting. So as that becomes public, it's going to be hard, you know, you're going to sort of break away this, tear away this mask of this formal legitimacy as that becomes public. And then when you have the president of the National Assembly, who's implicated in drug trafficking, silencing opposition members of the assembly, stripping away their committee chairmanships and refusing to allow them to speak, again, this kind of more brute force is that they're going to, that they feel desperately, where they're compelled and they're desperate to use these, to hold on to power, and they have to use to these more, this raw force against their opposition. I think that will be, that sort of formal democracy is going to be seen as a farce. I think that's happened already. I think even in Latin America, you know, where they've sort of, where political leaders, sort of mainstream Democrats on the right and on the left, have just avoided making any judgments about Chavismo because they don't want to mud wrestle with Hugo Chavez. They don't need the guy to bully him, and what they might need is his free or cheap oil. But now with Chavez out of the picture, I think you're going to even see more skepticism expressed about the way Chavez managed to hold on to power, and the concentration of power in the hands of the president, and the politicization of every institution in the country, and this deep polarization that is obvious in the country, and everyone knows that. And then the military having such a prominent role in the politics, all of these things rub the folks in Latin America, who's very sensitive about these kinds of things, rub them the wrong way. And then I think if there is sort of violent repression, that's another thing that goes down very, very badly in Latin America, the use of force, killing protesters, things of that nature. You're not going to reach a, you know, 60,000 dead like you have in Syria. You know, if there were, you know, 60 people killed in Venezuela by a desperate regime, that would be a huge, huge scandal. So, again, as they have to take the gloves off to hold on to power, they take the mask off of legitimacy as well, I think.
Thank you, Ambassador. Are there any international bodies looking at the election, what happened and the results?
Well, there were no international observers except for, I think it was maybe a delegation of UNASUR or perhaps ALBA. These are associations that Chavez essentially created to exclude the United States, and they were mostly puppets of his regime. So there has been no impartial observer.
Right.
You know, even Jimmy Carter, who's hardly impartial, who pronounced the Venezuelan electoral system to be better than ours, he wasn't even invited to observe. And the OAS wasn't invited either. The OAS Secretary General, who's really pulled his punches against the regime and on the contrary, sort of followed Chavez's lead in terms of you know, what he, how the OAS operated and what it paid attention to, they offered to technical support for a recount, but as soon as a recount was not in question or wasn't in play, the OAS backed off. So there really isn't any sort of serious international attention. There are some international respected NGOs, Human Rights Watch. I should mention the OAS Human Rights Commission, which is not really part of the OAS formally. They're more independent. They have for really a decade sort of recorded this march toward a dictatorship, really, and they have sort of documented some of these things. But in terms of the elections, there really isn't any international body, public or private, that is engaged.
All right, we've got another audience member with a question. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, thanks for the talk. I noticed that Maduro appointed a new diplomat to take charge of the dialogue between Venezuela and the U.S. I was wondering if you thought that was a sign of some potential thawing, or whether maybe it's a sign of desperation on Maduro's part, that he may actually seek some kind of rapprochement with the U.S. in order to try to resolve the problems that are in Venezuela.
Right. Well, what they're concerned about, clearly, is that the United States at this point has withheld recognition. And I think they feel that they can overcome that by appearing open to a dialogue. And the fellow they've appointed, Calixto Ortega, is a capable negotiator and is considered a serious guy. It's interesting he doesn't speak English, which is kind of is going to sort of limit his effectiveness in terms of public communication and carrying their message, getting their message out. But I would I think it is really a tactical thing on their part. You know, it's absolutely out of the question that a government whose senior leaders and security representatives of their security forces are involved in narco-trafficking, it's absolutely out of the question that they would cooperate with us in any serious way on countering drugs, which is a serious concern that the administration will want to raise with them. The Iranians certainly don't want to give up the relationship, and so even if we raise that, I don't think we're going to get any real satisfaction from the Venezuelans. It really remains to be seen how comfortable Secretary of State John Kerry is being, if I can use this word, isolated, or being alone in not recognizing the Venezuelan regime. I think, quite frankly, we're on the right side of history finally on this question, and I don't necessarily think we're going to we're feeling a lot of pressure to change our views, particularly since Congress, in a bipartisan way, is more and more mobilized and informed about the threats that this Chavista regime has represented to U.S. interests. So I think there is a certain matter of tactical moderation being shown by Maduro's government, which is probably intelligent, but I just don't know whether they're going to be able to deliver anything real in terms of cooperation with the United States. And if we are tough about some essential concerns that we have, I don't think we're going to be in any hurry to normalize a relationship with the narco state that's hosting Iran in our hemisphere.
Let me make another call for questions. If you have a question, our phone lines are open. Push the star button. and then the pound button on your telephone, star button and then pound button on your telephone. While we're waiting to see if there's a final question, let me make an announcement about the balance of the week here. We have two more calls scheduled for this week. Tomorrow, Thursday the 25th, at noon, 12 noon at the same number, we'll be talking about the perceived war on women here in the United States. And then Friday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, all these times are Eastern times, we'll talk about Missouri versus McNeely, which is a Supreme Court case that concerns the warrantless blood test without consent in drunk driving cases. It looks like we do have another question from our audience, so let's go to our next caller.
Thank you, Ambassador, for a very interesting informative talk. I tuned in a little bit late, so forgive me if you already spoke to this, but I'm interested in the what does the future hold for relations between the governments and maybe also the people of Colombia and Venezuela?
Well, it's a very interesting relationship because they really depend on one another on an economic level. And Colombia used to be Venezuela's one of Venezuela's largest trading partners, second, of course, to us because of the oil and, quite frankly, our export of consumer goods to Venezuela. But the Colombians have had an important economic relationship that went awry when President Uribe, Alvaro Uribe, the previous president of Colombia, and Chavez locked horns on a regular basis in an intense way toward the end of Uribe's term about 3 or 4 years ago. The current president of Colombia, Juan Manuel Santos, has been has changed that relationship in a radical way. He's changed. He was one of the first, for example, to recognize Maduro's victory, which surprised a lot of people that Colombia rushed out ahead on that. Santos has sort of depended on the Venezuelan government's good offices with the Cuban government and with the Colombian rebels to sponsor peace talks that have been going on in Cuba for the last, on and off for the last 8 or 9 months. And another round of talks is supposed to start soon in Cuba. They, you know, what Santos has wanted out of that relationship is Chavez's ability to lean on the Colombian guerrillas to abide by some sort of agreement where they would limit their operations in Colombian territory. I don't think they'd ever sort of lay down their arms, but sort of end their armed struggle. That is that would be an historic achievement in Santos's opinion, if he could get that sort of formal agreement. And really requires the cooperation of Cuba and before Hugo Chavez. Maduro, on the other hand, really has no real muscle with the FARC, the Colombian guerrillas. And as a matter of fact, he's managed to sort of surrender all of the influence, all of the weight of the relationship with Cuba. He's sort of where the Havana's in the driver's seat, even though Havana depends on Venezuela. But he sort of depends on the Cuban security apparatus and its political operations to hold on to power in Venezuela. So he doesn't have the kind of muscle with either the FARC or with Cuba to make an agreement stick. So in Chavez's absence, Santos is probably going to just play this peace process out with the FARC, and the Colombian Congress has said they want these talks to either produce an agreement or come to an end in July. This is an election year in Colombia, so Santos will probably he'll press for some sort of formal agreement, again with Venezuela's help. But it's less likely that he'll be able to produce some kind of outcome because Chavez is no longer around to make it stick. I think the relationship will continue, this bilateral relationship will continue where the Colombians will position themselves to be helpful in terms of, you know, delivering consumer goods to Venezuela as shortages increase. in the months ahead, and if the Venezuelan economy fails to produce, it's going to become more and more dependent on Colombian imports. And so that relationship will be important, you know, mostly from an economic standpoint. And I don't think Santos is going to be the guy whoever presses the Venezuelans for cooperation on drug trafficking. He has refused to acknowledge Venezuela's role in narco trafficking, and as a matter of fact, has sort of gone along with the fiction that the Venezuela is a partner in good faith against drug trafficking. So as long as Santos is in there, and I think it's likely that he will be reelected, I think the relationships is going to be very sort of on a normal, even keel.
All right, let's take another caller question.
Hi, this is Gunnar Gunderson. I'm an associate at IRL in Manila in L.A. And I have actually family members in Venezuela, and I was wondering, one of my cousins is a medical student at the University of Los Andes, and there was those motorcyclist guys who kind of shot up the clinic there. What's the thoughts on whether or not, how will that element be able to be controlled, even if the Maduro regime was kind of brought down by this kind of recount push? And
right.
And also, second prong to that question is that's the main point. It's like there's these lawless groups running around.
Sure.
And then the second point would be that there's also groups in Venezuela who are supportive of the regime that just don't believe that this violence is occurring on behalf of their political persuasion, and just wondering, what's real, how realistic is it that those folks are going to be in some way, how can you reach those groups to get them to see that it's actually their political party that's creating the violence?
Sure.
Kind of thing.
There are a lot of Chavistas who have been supporters of Chavez who just do not see Maduro able to manage things. They don't have any confidence in him. He ran a rather buffoonish campaign, and they're every day there's a new joke about how stupid Maduro is. And I don't use that word with disrespect. Frankly, I'm just sort of characterizing the way they describe popular image of the guy. Those folks are just going to look for whoever can sort of manage the economy and keep a certain control on the already sort of very difficult security conditions in the country, the personal security, vast number of murders in the country, all of which are unsolved, no operable court system and all of, or even police system. So those Chavistas are going to be more, are going to naturally sort of peel away, to the opposition, because this current political leader, Capriles Radonsky, has actually behaved rather responsibly and seen as more of a statesman. So I actually think that a lot of the Chavistas are, I call them political orphans because Chavez died, that Capriles can sort of peel those people away. And now the crux of your question on these sort of armed groups, these people running around on motorcycles, a lot of those people are Cubans. By the way, these motorized groups, they're on motorcycles going around emptying pistols into crowds of people, are modeled on the Basij groups in Iran that crushed the so-called Green Revolution. They're literally modeled on that, to sort of take the streets and to sow fear. Quite frankly, I don't think it's going to work so much with the Venezuelan folks anymore. I think they've had it. They've had 14 years of this lawlessness and corruption, and I think that these groups are going to encounter a much more resolute opposition, even when it comes to taking the streets. Immediately after the election, the National Guard hit the streets and was emptying, tear gassing and beating up protesters. About 8 or 9 people killed. But it hasn't been these irregular forces or militias that have been unleashed on the people quite yet. How will they deal with them? It would have to be the military. The military is deeply divided. There are a lot of active duty officers who are on house arrest and have been for years. They keep their positions, but they are on house arrest because they're considered being disloyal. There are people who are concerned about the alliances with Iran and terrorism. There are people concerned about alliances with narco-trafficking. There are others, even at the very senior levels, including Diosdado Cabello, who is himself a narco-trafficker, who hates the Cubans, or has hated the Cubans, and historically Venezuelan military folks will say, I was trained to kill Cubans, not to take orders from Cubans. You need a military to disarm the militias and to control those people, and that is an absolute requirement. So if a substantial part of the military does not go along with the political program, let me put it this way. People often talk about violence and civil war and all of this in Venezuela. Well, only one side has the guns, really. It's Chavismo. So it will have to be a situation, in order to control these folks, where a substantial number of the Chavistas who run the military, who have line authority in the military, decide that they're going to control and disarm the militias and control, disarm and maybe oust the Cubans who resort to these violent methods.
Well, Ambassador, thank you so much for your participation today. We've got a few minutes left. I wonder if you want to make a final statement or express any final thoughts in wrapping up here today.
Well, I just want to emphasize that this is something that the American people should be concerned with, because the gang violence in this country, the drug problem in this country, can be traced to lawlessness in Venezuela and in Central America and Mexico. President Obama is going to the region around the 1st through the 4th of May. He's going to be traveling to Mexico and then to Costa Rica. And I hope that we do our part in dealing with this drug trafficking, because our consumption fuels it. There are governments that want to do the right things. They just do not have the resources, and they require cooperation of the United States and not only solidarity, but material and technical assistance to get a hold of this problem, because it threatens a couple of countries in Central America in very profound ways, and we have to do our part in helping apply the rule of law in those countries.
Ambassador Noriego, thank you so much for being with us today. It's been a very interesting and somewhat atypical event for us. I certainly appreciate you joining us and sharing your insights. To the audience, I want to remind you about and invite you to our Teleform conference call tomorrow at 12 noon Eastern Time at this same number, when we'll be discussing the perceived war on women. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.